For those of you who do catch up online with this class, and if you access it through Torah Media Atlanta, you should be aware that Yisrael Killian, who runs Torah Media Atlanta, reached out because donations to that site are down. For those of you who do take advantage of it, I would suggest making a donation online when you do use it so that he can continue that site. It is June the 25th. Okay. And we are in Shmuel Beis. We're up to Perek Gimel, Chapter 3.
Yes.
Last thing we had was the unfortunate events of the battle between Yoav's forces and Avner's forces and the death of Asael. And that created a certain, there was a certain animosity between the two forces, but now you have a rivalry between David or David's kingdom in Yehuda and Ish-bosheth, who is the son of Shaul, and his kingdom over the rest of Israel. It goes on for approximately 7 years, and for that time David, his seat of power is in Hebron. And over that course of time, as we described last week, the balance of power shifts more and more to David and further from Ish-bosheth. And that's what the Pesukim describe right over here. V'atiyah milchama arukah, there was a drawn-out battle, bain beis Shaul v'bain beis David, between the house of Shaul and the house of David. V'David holeich v'chazek, David was going and becoming stronger. Uvei Shaul holchem v'dalem, and the house of Shaul was going and getting weaker. When it says there was a war, it does not necessarily mean hand-to-hand combat, and does not necessarily mean casualties, at least not in battle, but it means there was a struggle for control over Eretz Yisrael, and David is constantly getting stronger, and the house of Shaul under Ish-bosheth is constantly getting weaker over the 7 years. The Navi now describes to us David's first children. Remember, he has 6 wives, so we're going to describe the children from each of the wives. But we had only mentioned before really 3 of them, of the wives, but we'll see there are more. Vayilodu LeDavid banim b'Chevron. David had sons in Chevron. Vahi v'choro Amnon. The oldest one was Amnon la'achinoam ha'Israelis. He was born to Achinoam, the Israelis. Umishneu, the second one was Kilav la'Avigail. Eshes Naval ha'Karmeli. That was the son of Avigail. Vashlishi Avshalom ben Ma'acha. The third one was Avshalom, the son of Ma'acha, bas Talmai Melech Geshur, who was the daughter of Talmai, the king of Geshur. we'll talk about her in a moment. V'Ravi Adoniah ben Chagis, the fourth one was Adoniah, the son of Chagis. V'Chamishi Shifatya ben Avital, that's the fifth one. V'Ashishi Yisra'am La'egla Eshes David, to Egla, the wife of David. Eila Yuldu LeDavid B'Chevron, these were born to David in Hebron. So let's work this a little bit backwards. The sixth one, which is Yisram to Egla, the wife of David. We mentioned 5 wives of David before Egla. So why would Egla be called the wife of David more than the other ones? So what do you think?
The favorite?
Okay, so she would be the favorite or the main wife of David. At this point, David has not yet married Bathsheba, and his main wife or his favorite wife is Egla. And the irony is, he wasn't even living with Egla, because Egla is another name for Michal. Michal, the daughter of Shaul, which is really his first wife. Mm-hmm. And remember, she was taken away from him when he ran away from Shaul. And we'll discuss her presently. She's going to come back in the picture soon. So so her name is, that's Michal. And she's called Egla, which is a language of endearment. And that's why she has the name Egla. And there is going to be a pasuk later, as we will learn, that Michal, because of the way she's going to speak in a degrading manner towards David, the punishment is going to be that she will not have children for her life. It says, until she died, she had no children. So Chazal, therefore, are bothered by who is this Yisra'am, if Egla, it says later on, Michal doesn't have any children, and they explain that this means that later on, when we learn about it, it will mean that she will not have any more children. But there was a child born prior to that incident, and that's Yisra'am. These children are going to come up, not every one of them, but most of them are going to come up again later in Shmuel Beis, and And on most of them, it's going to be under rather distressing circumstances. Most everyone is familiar with Avshalom and his rebellion, which we'll have later on. We also will have Adoniah, the fourth one, who's also going to attempt a rebellion against Shlomo. That'll be in the beginning of Malachim in the book of Kings. We also have Amnon, the first son, who is going to end up getting in trouble as well, as we will see later on. So David has many wives, he has many children, but he has a lot of trouble from his children. He ends up having a lot of tzar gidol banim, a lot of trouble raising his children. However, the second one, Kilav, to Abigail, Eshes Nabal, Kilav has another name. His other name is Daniel. And the Gemara says, why was his name called Kilav? So there are two answers given. One is Kilav is a contraction of Ki, which means like, and Laav to his father, like to father. Because there were those who suggested that Abigail, gave birth to Kilav, that Kilav had been conceived from her first husband, from Nabal, not from David. And so HaKadosh Baruch Hu made Kilav look like David. Kilav appeared like David. And therefore, his name, the Navi calls him Kilav, like his father. Which means he appeared like his father. There is another explanation given that the word, it's a little bit difficult to fit it into the letters. But he was a great Talmud Chacham, Kilav was. And he was a Talmud Chacham who was of the greatest in his generation. And he used to be able to answer questions and to ask questions of the greatest in the generation. The Gemara says that there are four people who died be'ito shel nachash. They died because of the etzah, because of the advice of the snake. They only died, they had no averos, and they only died because Adam and Chava ate from the etz hadas, ate from the tree of knowledge. There are four people like that. So those four people, anybody know any of them?
Yishai.
Okay, we have Yishai, the father of David. Okay, who else? When? The Gemara lists it as two fathers and two sons. So Yishai is called the father. Yishai, the father of David.
Well,
we'll get to Kilav. Amram, who is the father of Moshe. Binyamin, the son of Yaakov. And Kilav, the son of David. Those are the four the Gemara lists. So David has a father and a son who are in that illustrious list. So Kilav is one of them. And it's noteworthy that Abigail is his mother. We learned about Abigail before, and you see that in this list of sons who were born to David, and several of them ended up having difficulties later on, but Abigail is the one who has a son who instead outshines everybody, is of the greatest Talmidei Chacham and the greatest Torah sages of his generation, and dies without having ever sinned. So that is a testament to Abigail and to her righteousness that she raises a son like that from David.
But I thought you said that he was not actually David's son.
No, there were those who suggested that he wasn't, and that's why Hashem made him look like David, to make sure that everybody knew he was David's son.
So he was?
Yes, he was David's son. That's correct.
Do we hear anything about him later?
We do not hear much about him later, no. No, although we'll talk about him hopefully at some point. With all of these sons born over here, though, none of them end up being the successor to David. We all know that. The successor to David is Shlomo, and Shlomo's wife has not been married to David yet. That's going to be Bathsheba. So although he has these wives, and they are all wonderful, but they are not, none of them are able to produce the next king. Even Abigail, who produces Kilav, does not produce the next king. Even Michal, who is Egla, who herself comes from royalty, does not produce the next king. So we'll see later when we get to the story of Bathsheba what were the qualities necessary to produce the heir to the throne, of which none of them do. There are those who have designs on the throne. Avshalom, as we know, is going to rebel. He's going to want the throne. And Adoniyahu is going to want the throne as well. A word about Avshalom's mother, Avshalom ben Maacha, Bas Talmai Melech Geshur. So she was the daughter of Talmai, the king of Geshur, who was not Jewish. So it seems that Maacha herself, was a Yefas Toach, which means that she was captured in war, and ended up becoming David's wife under those circumstances. It's not clear whether it was Maacha herself or whether it was it is Maacha herself. I mean, in theory, it could be Maacha's mother, but you know, because sometimes when it says the daughter of, it doesn't mean directly the daughter; it could mean granddaughter. But it appears that Maacha herself was a Yefas Toach. When we get to the rebellion of Shalom, we'll discuss that further as well, Mirza Hashem.
Can I ask a question here? Is Talmai the same as Talmi, what we call
them? No. The Ptolemic kings are they follow Alexander. When Alexander died, so his empire was divided up amongst his generals, of which Talmai was one of them, Talmi, and that he had the area around Egypt. And that's much later, right? You're talking about during the second Beis Hamikdash. This is prior to the first. So it's a difference of probably 700 years. Although, perhaps he got his name from here. I don't know.
It might be one of those ceremonial
titles. Pasuk Vav, verse 6. Vayhi biyos hamilchama bein Beis Shaul lebein Beis David. And it was when the war was between the house of Shaul and the house of David, the struggle. But Avner haya mischazek veShaul. Avner was trying to strengthen the house of Shaul. He's the one who anointed Ish-bosheth as king. And remember, the reason he did it was because he expounded a verse. He darshened the pasuk that showed that there would be kings coming from Binyamin, not king singular, but kings plural. And therefore, he understood that even though Shaul was dead, and the heir to the throne, Yonasan, was also dead, he should still anoint another king from Binyamin, which he did, which is Ish-bosheth. Even though Avner knew, as we will see presently, that David was eventually going to take over all of Eretz Yisrael, he knew that Hashem had given the kingship over to David, but he still held, because of the pasuk that he expounded, that he darshaned correctly, that there was going to be another king, and therefore, for the time being, for the present, his job was to strengthen the house of Shaul. That's what he did. He did it not because he felt some sort of personal allegiance or because he had some enmity towards David, but rather he did it because he understood that that was the Ratzon Hashem, that was the will of Hashem, that right now there be a rivalry in the kingdom, and that his job was to strengthen the house of Shaul, which he did faithfully. However, Pasuk Zion, verse 7, Ulishol Pilegesh Ushma Ritzva Vas Aya. Shaul had a Pilegesh, a concubine, whose name was Ritzva Vas Aya. We are going to learn about Ritzva Vas Aya much later, towards the end of Shmuel Beis. She was a great tzaddikess. Ritzva Vas Aya was a great tzaddikess, a very righteous woman, and we'll learn about her righteousness much later on. But here she's only mentioned because of what's going to happen to Avner. So he had a Pilegesh, he had a concubine whose name was Ritzva Vas Aya, Vayomer al Avner, and he said to Avner, he means Ish-bosheth, the king, said to Avner, Madua basa el Pilegesh avi. How come you had a relationship with the Pilegesh, with the concubine of my father? So this was an accusation that Ish-bosheth says towards Avner. Now, it's important to know exactly what this accusation meant and why Avner reacts as he does. So let's keep going. We'll come back to exactly what this is. Vayichal Avner ma'od. Avner was very upset. Al divrei Ish-bosheth, the words of Ish-bosheth. Vayomer, and he said, Harosh Kelev Anochi Asher Liyehuda Hayom. I'm sorry, the comment is after Liyehuda. Let's read that again. Harosh Kelev Anochi Asher Liyehuda. Harosh, is it better to be Rosh means head, which means in charge, meaning is it better for me to be in charge in the house of Shaul, or is it better for me to be a dog, Kelev Anochi, a dog in Yehuda? Meaning, I'd rather be a dog in Yehuda than be the head here in the house of Shaul. Hayom etzah chesedim bein Shaul avicha. Today, I would do chesed with the house of Shaul, your father, el echav, to his brothers, vel meireyehu, and to his entourage, to his friends. V'lo him tzisicha biyad David, I didn't give you over in the hands of David. And now you're visiting upon me the sin of this woman today? Meaning I've done all this for you, I've been faithful. It's better to be a dog in the house of David than it is to be a head for Shaul. I'm not doing this because it's prestigious. I'm not doing this because it's good for me. I'm doing this because it's something which I feel is right. I've been doing chesed for the house of Shaul, your father, for his brothers, for his entourage, and I didn't give you over the house of David, and then you come and you accuse me of this? So Hashem should do to Avner, so he should add to him, so he should add, if that's an oath, ki kasher nishba Hashem to David, ki chein eselo, for as Hashem swore to David, then that's what I will do for him. In other words, I've had it with you, I am now going to promote David. Lahavir hamam vachami bein Shaul transfer the royalty from the house of Shaul ulahakim es kisei David and to establish the throne of David al Yisrael val Yehuda on all of Yisrael and Yehuda midan vaad Beersheba from the north which is done all the way to the south to Beersheba. So he now, Avner says, that's it, I am switching allegiance, I am going to promote David. He could no longer answer Avner anything, because he feared him. Ish-bosheth could not answer Avner. Avner was the one who was really the power behind Ish-bosheth. Avner, as we mentioned before, last week, Avner's great, he was the great Talmud Chacham Avner, and the great warrior, which was, as we said before, those go together in those days. Those two things went hand in hand. And Avner was unparalleled in his greatness, both as a warrior and as a Talmud Chacham. And it was his influence and his doing that kept Ish-bosheth going. As much as the royalty was shifting, the power was shifting from Ish-bosheth to David, nevertheless, whatever Ish-bosheth had was because of Avner. And now Avner says that I'm done. I'm going to promote David. Now, if it's true what I told you before that Avner had promoted Ish-bosheth because of a pasuk, and in fact Avner himself says, "I'm not doing this because it's good for me," so then we have to understand why does he react this way? If Hashem wants Ish-bosheth to be king, so it shouldn't matter how Avner is treated. If Avner sees his role is to be promoting Ish-bosheth. So even if he's treated badly, if you're a servant of Hashem, you do whatever Hashem says you should do, irrespective of how you're treated. Now, we lesser people might react this way, but Avner, the great Avner, should not be personally insulted and react this way. So it must be that Avner was not personally insulted. This wasn't a personal insult. He wasn't saying, well, if you're going to do this, you're going to accuse me, then forget it, and then I'm done. It must be that Avner understood that if Ish-bosheth would make this accusation, then it's time to move over to David. Then the time has come. That clearly Hashem no longer wants him to be promoting Ish-bosheth. So we'll talk about that in a moment, exactly what was the thing that Avner saw that causes him to switch allegiance. And therefore, Pasuk Yud Beis, verse 12, Vayishlach Avner Malachim al David, and Avner sent messengers to David, Tachtav Lamor, under him saying, Lemi Aretz, to who is the land? Now, this word under him, is the simple meaning is from where he was. From where he was, he sent a message to David. But it's a strange way to say it, and we'll talk about what it means in a moment. So, he sent under him to David, Lemi Aret, to the one who is in charge of the land, which means I swear by Hashem. This is an oath. He's saying, I swear by Hashem who is in charge of the land. Lemar to say, Karsa Vrischa Iti, you should make a covenant with me. Vine Yadi Imach, my hand will be with you. Vahasev Elechas Kol Yisrael, to turn to you all of the Jewish people, which means that make a covenant with me and I will now bring all the Jewish people along to you. You will now be in charge of the entire country. So that was his message to David. Vayomer, David said, Tov, good. Ani achros itcha bris, I will make a covenant with you. Ach davar echad anochi shom itcha lemor. But there is one thing I'm asking of you. Lo sira es panai, you should not see my face. Kim lifnei hevi acha es michal bas shol, until you bring michal, the daughter of shol, bevo acha liros es panai, when you come to see my face. Bring my wife, bring michal to me when you come to see me. So come along with michal, don't come by yourself. Vayishlach David malachim al Ishbosheth ben Shaul lemar. David sent messengers to Ishbosheth, the son of Shaul, saying, Tanah es ishti es michal, give my wife michal, asherati li b'mea arlos plishtim, that I married with the 100 foreskins of the plishtim, which we learned about in Shmuel Aleph. Vayishlach Ishbosheth, so Ishbosheth sent, vayikachela, and he took her me'im ish from a man, me'im paltiel ben Laish, from paltiel ben Laish. From a man, from Paltiel ben Laish. What kind of language is that? Obviously he's a man. So why is it say he's a man? And the reason is because Paltiel ben Laish is of the greatest tzaddikim we will ever learn about. Although he is rarely mentioned in Tanakh, he is, the Gemara talks about him as being in certain aspects greater than Yosef and greater than Boaz. An incredibly great tzaddik, and we'll talk about him hopefully in a few moments. Vayelech ita isha, her husband went with her. Her husband means Paltiel ben Laish, went with her. Haloch uvachol, going and crying achareha, after her. Ad bachurim, until bachurim. Vayomer elav Avner, Avner said to him, Leich shuv, go back. Vayashov, and he went back. So now, not only is Avner bringing the country around to David, but now Michal is back with David. We have to deal with, why couldn't David have sent for Michal before this point? David doesn't send to Avner to get Michal, he sends to Ishbosheth to get Michal. And Ishbosheth sends to Paltiel ben Laish to send Michal to David. So, clearly, Ishbosheth is in control of whether Michal stays with Paltiel ben Laish or goes to David. So why is it that now it's contingent, David makes a condition that if Avner is to come to David, he is to bring Michal with him. Pasuk Yedzayim, verse 17. Udvar Avner haya im zikne Yisrael lemar. The words of Avner were with the elders of Yisrael, saying, Gam tomol gam shalshom eyisem evakshem es David lemelech aleichem. Really, yesterday, the day before, you really wanted David to be king over you. Meaning that you really were thinking about doing that, and I was the one who convinced you not to. I was the one who promoted Ishbosheth. Ve'atonel asu, you should do. Meaning you should go to David. Ki Hashem amar el David, lema Hashem said to David, saying, Be'ad David avdi Hoshia es ami Yisrael, mi'ad plishtim, in the hands of David my servant, he saved my nation Yisrael from the plishtim, u'mi'ad kol ayvem, from all their enemies. And Avner also spoke in the ears of the tribe of Binyamin, which would be the last holdouts for Shaul. Avner also went to speak in the ears of David in Hebron. All that was good in the eyes of Yisrael and the eyes of Binyamin. In other words, he went to give David advice about how to win over the rest of the country. Avner had the ear of everybody, and therefore he was able to broker this deal to get David now to be in control of the whole country. Avner came to David to Hebron. He had 20 men with him. He made a feast for them. Vayomer Avner el David. Avner said to David, Akuma ve'eleicha, I'll get up and I'll go. Ve'ekbitza el Adoni ha'melech es kol Yisrael, I will gather from my master the king all of Yisrael. Ve'yichrasu itcha bris, and they will make a covenant with you. U'malachta b'chol asher te'ava nafshecha, you will rule over all that your heart desires. Vayishalach David es Avner. David sent Avner. Vayelach v'shalom, and he went in peace. Avner went in peace. Okay, then he's going to be killed in just a few seconds. So we are going to pause here for this week, and we have plenty to cover right now before we get to what happens to Avner and Yoav, which is going to be the next, the rest of the balance of this parak, this chapter. We'll leave that for 2 weeks from today. So this is really much about Avner more than anybody else. Avner, as we said, he understood that David was to be king over everybody, but he learned from a pasuk that it was his job to promote, to first anoint and then promote a king that otherwise would not have been able to be king. Without Avner, Ish-bosheth could never have been king. He didn't have the standing amongst the people. Avner did, and Avner was the common denominator. He was the thread that connected everybody back to Shaul, because Avner was the great general of Shaul, and in Avner you still saw the greatness of Shaul. With the death of Shaul and Yehonah's son, we lost almost all the grandeur of Shaul, the greatness of Shaul. Shaul being the great warrior, Yehonah's son being the great warrior, the two of them being great Talmidei Chachamim. With their deaths, almost all of the greatness of the house of Shaul was gone. Avner was the one piece that remained with his greatness, and therefore he still had the ear of the people, and the emotions of the people were still attached to Avner, and he therefore was able, and he was the only one who was able to do what the Torah said to do, which is to make sure that there is another king from the house of Shaul. Why Hashem wanted that is a good question. Perhaps we'll tackle that another time, but that there should be a continuing rivalry between the house of Shaul and the house of David was what Hashem wanted, and only Avner was able to do that. And therefore, Avner promoted Ish-bosheth. He did this for a time, and meanwhile, during this time, slowly but surely, Ish-bosheth and the house of Shaul's power is eroding, while David and his house is gaining strength. Even with all of Avner's trying to promote Ish-bosheth, but there's constantly this erosion and the power moving to David. If Avner is the only one who can promote Ish-bosheth, then, by the same token, Avner can
promote David.
Right, he can remove Ish-bosheth. He's the one. Without Avner, Ish-bosheth is finished. So it's only through Avner that he can be promoted and he can have standing. Without Avner, then the power will automatically shift to David. Maybe it's not complete, maybe it's not really right away, you know, suddenly, but definitely the Avner abandoning Ish-bosheth will precipitate the shift in power. Now, Avner is faithfully trying to promote Ish-bosheth until Ish-bosheth accuses him of taking the pilagish of his father, of Ritzvah Bas Ayah. Now, what is this accusation? Was this a sin that he was accusing him of doing? What was exactly the thing? Now, let's understand something. If Avner sees himself as the one who's promoting Ish-bosheth, who really has the power, Avner or Ish-bosheth?
Avner.
Is Avner using that power for himself?
No.
Avner is not assuming the throne himself. It would seem that he could have. He could have said, listen, everybody, I'm king. I'm taking over for Shaul. He probably could have gotten away with that. Not gotten away with it with Hashem, but gotten away with it down here for a time, because he did have the ear of the people.
Was he from Binyamin?
Avner, it appears, was from Binyamin, it would seem. So he could have done that, but he didn't. He was faithful. He said, it's not my job to be king. So he promotes Ish-bosheth. But you can see that there is definitely a risk here of Avner actually assuming the throne, if not in fact, but if not in practice, but who's really calling the shots over here? You would imagine Ish-bosheth is very careful with Avner, and that he wants to make sure he knows what Avner says. You know, just as Avner says to David, "I will." He goes to speak to David to advise David about how to win over the people. I'm sure he was advising Ish-bosheth, and Ish-bosheth is definitely listening very carefully. So if you're a king in that position, you recognize that you're not really that strong. You're really only there because of Avner. There is a discussion about Pelegesh, about concubines, over who is allowed to take one. There is certainly a very strong opinion that only kings are allowed to take Pelegeshim in the first place. A concubine is a woman who is married but without, it's a discussion exactly what she doesn't have, but it seems she doesn't have a ksuba, without a marriage contract. It's a different type of marriage. And it's unclear again who's allowed to take one. A king is certainly allowed to take one. I don't mean only one, but meaning is allowed to take a pilagshim, concubines. Whether anybody else is or not is a matter of debate. The rule is that if a king has something, let's say a king has a horse or a throne or an item that he uses, no one else is allowed to use that item. And that is an act of rebellion if one does. After a king dies, then the question is, what do you do with everything else that he had? And it is acceptable, according to many opinions, for his son to take over the things that he had. So his throne, his horse, etc. But no one else can. And a widow of a king can't go and marry just anybody, because she was married to the king, and no one else is worthy of the widow. And obviously she can't marry his son, just because that would be incest. So there, a widow of a king cannot remarry, because there's no one to remarry who is appropriate for her, unless there's another king. Another king she can marry. When Avshalom is going to rebel against David, one of the things he's going to do to prove that he is king is he's going to have a relationship with David's Pelegeshim. It's going to be an act of defiance to prove and show to everyone that he is really the king. Taking the Pelegesh of the king, who isn't the actual wife, but is a sort of wife, it was a way of showing that you're in power. Here, Ish-bosheth accuses Avner of usurping the throne. It wasn't an accusation of some sort of illicit relationship, which it would have been, but not because, I mean, the Pelegesh's husband was no longer alive. So if it wasn't the king, anybody could marry her, but it was an accusation of rebellion. You have usurped the throne. It is unclear to me whether Avner really did or didn't marry Ritzva Vatayah. She was a great tzaddikess. So I don't know whether he did or didn't. And I don't know whether he may have been allowed to, because Shaul's kingship is shifting. I don't know. It could be he didn't, it could be he did, I don't know. But whatever it is, Ish-bosheth is accusing Avner of taking the throne for himself. So Avner says to Ish-bosheth, "You think I'm doing this because I want to be in control? Harosh? Because I want to be in charge? I'd rather be a dog in the house of David," meaning to be the lowest on the totem pole, to be a peon in the house of David, "than to be the head of the house of Shaul. I'm not doing this because it's something that I want. I'm doing this because it's what HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants. But if you're accusing me of usurping the throne, then already it appears that you, Ish-bosheth, are no longer the king. Because if you are seeing me as a threat to you, that means the people are seeing me as the king and not you. Because this is not happening in a vacuum. If you're reading what I'm doing as a rebellion, as usurping the throne, that comes in context of what you're seeing in the kingdom in general. You're seeing a kingdom that is really being run by me, not by you, which means you're feeling threatened, which means you're thinking the people have allegiance to me, not to you. That means this is all just a sham anyway. It's a house of cards. There's nothing really here. As long as you were clearly the king and I was clearly just someone who was faithful to you and promoting you, then fine. Then we are fulfilling what the Torah says, that there is a king who is the son of Sheol. But once it turns out that you're no longer feeling like you're king anymore, which is probably because people aren't seeing you that way, and you're accusing me of being the real king or being the rebelling, then the Torah's rule is not being met anymore. There really is no king for Sheol's house anymore. Really, I am the acting king. Well, that's not what the Torah wants. And therefore, I am giving up and I am moving over to the house of David. Because clearly, Hashem's will, which is that there be a second king for Sheol, that time has run its course, and now it's over. And now I am going to switch over to David, and I will help bring the people unto David so that it is a seamless transition, that it is not a traumatic transition, that it shouldn't, chas v'shalom, end up being some sort of rebellion with bloodshed, some sort of a civil war. I'm going to help to bring the kingdom into David. So it's not a reaction of revenge. It's not that Avner is saying, well, if you're going to treat me this way, that's not what it is. He's saying that if you're treating me this way, it must be that you're no longer really the king. That worked for a certain amount of time, and now it's time to move over to David. Yeah.
I know you told us last segment, what was that time frame?
The whole thing took about 7 years. David was in Hebron for 7.5 years. I don't know exactly when this happens in the grand scheme of things, whether it's after 2 years, after 4 years, it's unclear exactly where it happens, and nothing is sudden. It's all moving slowly in that direction. Even after Avner goes over to David, it still moves slowly in that direction. Now, Avner then says to David, he sends messages, David, I'm going to come over to you. Make me a covenant. So David says, that's fine, but you have to bring Michal with you. So, what is David saying with asking for Michal? When Sheol kept Michal back from David, remember, Michal is the daughter of Sheol. When David married Michal, that would have been the seamless transition from Sheol to David. We talked about this in Shmuel. We talked about how there's constantly this hope that it will not be it won't be a transition that
jarring.
I'm sorry?
It's jarring.
Yeah. There won't be bloodshed, that it'll be a seamless transition from Sheol to David. Even though Sheol has to lose the Meluchah, he's going to lose the kingdom, that we know, but it didn't have to be in a terrible way. And one of the ways it could have happened was through the fact that David is his son-in-law. So even though really his son should have been king, not his son-in-law, but it's not such a crazy leap to move from the father-in-law to the son-in-law, and then the son becomes the second in command. It could have been in a much more seamless way. Unfortunately, that's not what happened. Keeping Michal back from David and giving her to Paltiel ben Laish was a way of making a very clear division between Sheol and David, where she could have been the connection, and as we know, going to the Medici family, whatever, you're going to the whole European history, all the marriages were in order to create these alliances. And that's what could have happened here. By holding her back, there was a clear distinction and a division to keep the two apart. So Avner now is coming to say, I'm going to bring everybody under you, David. So David says, if you're going to do this, I don't want to do this as something which is like, we're slapping Ish-bosheth in the face, we're slapping the house of Sheol in the face, and we're saying, they're finished, they're done, forget them, now it's me, now it's David. David says, no, I don't want to do it that way. I want to do it with you bringing Michal over. That way people will at least see that it's not forsaking the house of Sheol completely. The house of Sheol has a kiyum, has a continuum in me with Michal as my main wife. She's called Ashes. She's called Ashes David, the main wife of David, even though later it's going to be Bathsheba, but right now the main wife of David is Michal. And so she becomes that transitional figure to bring over to David. So David insists upon it, and Avner acquiesces, and then David sends messengers to Ish-bosheth to send over Michal, and Ish-bosheth agrees and sends over Michal to David. So this is a way of keeping the house of Shaul in people's minds alive with David. Yeah.
So even though we read earlier that David had these sons born, was that later, and now we're going back and it's explaining how Michal comes to him?
I'm not sure.
I mean,
yeah, that's a good point. You mean, was she born? Was he born in Hebron?
It says he was born in Hebron.
Yeah. You're saying it wasn't before he ran away from Shaul.
Well, I don't know.
No, that's a good point. I was thinking at first that he was born earlier, but no, you're right. It seems that he was born here. So yeah, we have to say that this pasuk hey, verse 5 is really referring to after she comes back to David. That's a good point. While they were still in Hebron. Yeah, very good. Good point. Yeah.
But is she allowed to come back to it? Is she married to someone else?
Okay, good. That's what we're talking about now about Palti Bamlaish. Very good. Excellent question. And how could she go back to
it? They're all under 7 years old?
At this point? Yeah, they're all young. Yeah, they're all still young.
And he's the one that puts the children
in. Okay. So, we now have the incredible story of Paltiel ben Laish. I mentioned this to you before, but we're going to talk about it a little bit more in detail now and show really one of the most amazing and even shocking psukim in Navi is Pasuk Tezayin verse 16, which the Gemara Darsh is more expounds upon in detail. Palti ben Laish. Michal was given to Palti ben Laish. We talked about it at the time when Shaul did it. Shaul did not mean to take a married woman and give her to somebody else. Shaul held there was a technicality that invalidated the marriage of David and Michal. The Gemara says that was incorrect. David held the technicality was not a problem. Shaul held it was a problem. The halacha follows David that it was not a problem. And therefore Michal was in fact married to David. But Shaul held she was not. And Shaul took her and gave her to Palti ben Laish. Palti ben Laish was no slouch. He was a great tzaddik in his own right. And he gave her to Palti. Palti knew that the halacha followed David. Therefore, he was not allowed to live with Michal. But there's very little you can do if the king says to you, this is your wife. You can't really go and live someplace else. And you can't really send her away. You're stuck. So Palti had no choice. And therefore the Gemara says that Palti ben Laish did a greater act of self-restraint than Yosef and Boaz. He took, as we mentioned, a sword and put it in the bed between himself and Michal. And he said, anybody who crosses this line should get the sword. He put the sword in as a remembrance to him and to her that they are not to touch each other. And for years, they did not touch each other. For all that time. The Gemara says that Yosef was dealing with a married woman, but it was one time. It was one attempt on her part, and he ran away, which was an unbelievable act of self-restraint. But nevertheless, it was only one time. And Boaz, it was likewise only one time, and it was a greater, Boaz was a greater challenge, a greater test than with Yosef, because Yosef was dealing with a married woman, Boaz was dealing with a single woman. Then comes Palti ben Laish, and Palti ben Laish, the Gemara says, it was over the course of many years, and it was in the same bed, and he still had self-restraint, and as a result, he's given the credit as having done a greater act of self-restraint than the other two, which is really amazing. The Gemara says that what does it mean then when it says Vayelech ita isha, her husband went with her? He wasn't really her husband because her husband was really David. So what does it mean that her husband, meaning Palpiel ben Laish, went with her? So the Gemara says he cared for her as a husband. He took care of her. He provided her needs and took care of her like a husband, even though he never touched her. And then it says, Halochu v'cho, he was going and crying after her until they came to Bachurim. What do you mean he was going and crying? What was he crying over? So the Gemara says an unbelievable thing. The Gemara says he was going and crying because the mitzvah was leaving him. Now I want to explain what that means. We say every day in davening that Hashem should not bring us lidei nisayon, should not bring us to any kind of test. We don't want to be tested. We don't want to be in a position where we're going to be tested. We don't want to be in a place where we are tempted. It's not a good thing. And it is prohibited, it is usher for a person to go and put themselves in a place of temptation. The Gemara says, if a man is going to a certain place, he has to go someplace. And in there's two ways to go, two directions to go. In one direction, there are women who are not dressed properly. In the other direction, the women are dressed properly, or there are no women there. And he chooses to go in the direction the women are not dressed properly, and he keeps his eyes closed and doesn't look. The Gemara says, Nikra Rasha. He's called evil. He kept his eyes closed, but he's called evil. Why is he called evil? He did the right thing. He did the wrong thing. Because he went down the road where there was temptation. And no, you're not allowed. One is not allowed to put themselves in a position of temptation. At the same time, Hashem does test us. And very often, we have no choice but to be in a place of temptation. Whatever that temptation is. Whether the temptation is something like this, or whether it's food related, or whether it's lashon hara related, or whether it's anger related, or whatever it is, whatever the temptation is, or whether it's a positive thing, where we're tempted not to do chesed, or not to give tzedakah, whatever the issues are, any issue that we have, we're constantly being tempted and being challenged. But that's from Hashem, and that's acceptable. And when we are challenged by Hashem, it is our job to rise to the challenge. That's what we're here to do. That's why we were created. We were created to give honor to Hashem's name by living up to the challenges that He gives us, whatever those challenges are, whether they're between us and Him, whether they're between us and our fellow man, doesn't make a difference. We are here to bring out the kavod of Shamayim, to bring out the honor of heaven by living up to the challenges that He gives us. But they have to be given by Him. We're not allowed to create those challenges. Paltiel ben Laish didn't ask for this, but he was put in a position of incredible temptation. And he understood that it wasn't his choosing to do it. He was given it, and now it was his job to live up to it. And he did. And he did with flying colors. Now, she was being given back to David, which of course was the right thing. And Palti is crying. And he's crying because he no longer has the mitzvah. Because he can't put himself in temptation on purpose. Hashem had decreed that he would be in a position of temptation for several years. That time has come to an end, and now that incredible mitzvah is being removed from him, and he's crying for the loss of the mitzvah. It's an unbelievable thing. You see a window into Palti's ability to withstand his Yetzer Hara. How did he do it? How was he able to withstand? So the Gemara says he put this sword in there. But how was he able to withstand it? It seems that he constantly reminded himself, this is my mitzvah. This is my reason for existence. This is why I was created. It is to stand up to this temptation. This is why I'm here. He viewed it that way. He related it to her as his mitzvah that he was created to do. And to mivakadosh Hashem Shemayim, to sanctify God's name by withstanding temptation. And when she was removed from him, his mitzvah is being taken away, he cries. It's just an incredible window and insight into what it takes to be a great tzaddik. And that sometimes we think that thing, that problem that we have, that we go through every Yom Kippur and we do tshuva for it, and then we know we're going to be tempted again, and we don't know if we're going to be, and we're disappointed the next year. We're confessing for the same sin, and we keep going around and around in circles. And we're not breaking free of it. How do we ever break free of it? And here we're given a window into someone who was able to break free, who was able to fulfill his purpose in the world. And what is the window? First of all, that constant reminder of the sword, which is the negative reminder. Don't do it, because look what's going to happen. It's not going to feel good. It's going to be a sword. So he's got that constant reminder, but he also related to the whole situation as his purpose for being in the world. To the extent that when it's gone, he cries. That's not something which is beyond our ability to try to copy. We can take this and put it into our own lives in areas that we feel we can't ever overcome and say to ourselves, this is the challenge. We didn't ask for it, we didn't want it, but we have it. And if we have it, then this is our challenge, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu is saying, this is your reason for existence, and it's our job to live up to it. The Gemara says that when Yerushalayim was destroyed, second Beit HaMikdash was destroyed, I think it was Yerushalayim, it might have been Beit HaMikdash, I don't remember which destruction it was, but there were two people who were taken captive, a man and a woman. They were betrothed, they had kedushin, but they had not yet had nisuin, they had not had chuppah, which means there was no ksuba, there was no marriage document. And the people who captured them, the non-Jews who captured them, put them together. And she said to him, please don't touch me because we don't have a ksuba between ourselves. And he didn't. And for years they lived together and he didn't touch her. And when he died, she told the Talmidei Chachamim, you should be maspid him. You should eulogize him as being greater than Yosef because he did not touch me all these years. Rabbi Hapfer in Baltimore, one of the Rabbanim in Baltimore, one of the very highly respected Rav in Baltimore, told us that he met an old man. He met an old man, I believe when he was the Rav in Denver, he met this man. And this man had been in a bunker in World War II where he was hidden away. And he was hidden away for several years with his Kala, with his fiance. The two of them were hidden away, and they survived. They were not discovered by the Nazis, Yimach Shemam, and they survived. And as he was telling over the story to Rabbi Hapfer, Rabbi Hapfer told us that he said in an offhanded way, as you know, he was with her for whatever amount of time, you know, a couple, I don't know how many years it was that they were there, and he said to Rabbi Hapfer in like an offhanded kind of way, of course I never touched her, just said it like that, as if it was nothing. Rabbi Hapfer was amazed at the way the man said it. Like, as far as this man was concerned, not that, of course I didn't touch her. I mean, we were only engaged, we weren't married, so of course I didn't touch her. You know, so the incredible self-restraint that we have within us, we have the ability, we get it from Yosef, we get it from Boaz, we get it from Palti, we have it within us to have that level of self-restraint. It's there. And it's demonstrated here, but I'm telling you that it's happened in other generations and other times, even as recently as just not so long ago, a generation ago, it's not that long ago, that a man was locked up, could not leave, with his fiance, who I imagine that they were very interested in each other prior to being locked up together. And they did not touch each other for the time, the extended period of time they were together. You see the really the incredible self-restraint that we Jews are really able to do.
For those of you who do catch up online with this class, and if you access it through Torah Media Atlanta, you should be aware that Yisrael Killian, who runs Torah Media Atlanta, reached out because donations to that site are down. For those of you who do take advantage of it, I would suggest making a donation online when you do use it, so that he can continue that site.